Discussing the use of information systems in translational research, this is the NIH Clinical Center Biomedical Translational Research Informatics Seminar Series. Greetings and welcome to NIH Clinical Center's Biomedical Translational Research Informatics Seminar Series. On today's episode, we feature Dr. Henry Lowe, Associate Professor of Medicine, Biomedical Informatics, and Director of the Center for Clinical Informatics and Senior Associate Dean for Information Resources and Technology at Stanford University School of Medicine. Dr. Lowe will discuss a program at Stanford which is similar to the Beatrice program at the NIH Clinical Center. Now we take you to the Lipset Amphitheater in the NIH Clinical Center in Bethesda, Maryland, where Dr. Jim Cimino, Director of the Laboratory for Informatics Development, will introduce today's speaker.
Well, good afternoon. Thanks for coming. Oh, we got a couple more stragglers coming in. Thank you for coming. My name is Jim Cimino. I'm the Chief of the Laboratory for Informatics Development, and our lab is the sponsor for this monthly, more or less monthly seminar series on translational informatics. And this is the third of our series now, and I'm very delighted to introduce a friend and colleague, Henry Lowe, from Stanford University. Henry and I go way back. We were postdoc fellows in informatics together at Massachusetts General Hospital back in the mid-'80s, and did mumps programming together. He taught me everything I know about Macintoshes, which obviously wasn't much now, but he's since then he's been at University of Pittsburgh in the informatics department there, and then for the last 8 years he's been at Stanford University, where he's a senior associate dean for information resources and technology, and he's also the informatics director for the Stanford CTSA. And so he's going to talk to us today about the project he's doing there, which is analogous to the Beatrice project that we're doing here. So Henry.
Thank you, Jim. It's a pleasure to be here. I'd like to thank NIH for inviting me to speak. So I'm going to talk today about a project at Stanford University Medical Center called the STRIDE Project. And there are different facets to this project. I'm probably going to spend most of my time talking about the clinical data warehouse component of STRIDE. STRIDE stands for you have to have an acronym, of course, otherwise you couldn't have the T-shirts. Stands for the Stanford Translational Research Integrated Database Environment. Just a little bit of context here. Stanford University Medical Center is on the Stanford campus, which is about 45, 50 miles south of San Francisco. It's a beautiful campus. It's a complex research-intensive milieu. Stanford University School of Medicine has the highest NIH funding per faculty member of any university in the United States. We also have two high acuity hospitals, Lucile Packard Children's Hospital at Stanford and the Stanford Hospital and Clinics. We have an NCI-designated cancer center, and we now have a CTSA grant. We have three separate IT organizations in the medical center. In addition to my senior associate dean role, I'm the CIO at the medical school also. But these groups all work very closely together because our users expect an integrated and coherent environment to meet their needs. And I think that there's a lot of parallels between what I've heard from Jim this morning about NIH's needs, specifically around a research-focused data repository, and probably a lot of similarities between our environment and many academic medical centers in the United States. So hopefully our experiences over the last several years in this project will be helpful to others, perhaps just starting on this particular path. We have, as I mentioned, two hospitals that are part of Stanford University Medical Center. Lucile Packard Children's Hospital, in the last couple of years, implemented an electronic health record using the Cerner system. Prior to that, they had Meditech. And Stanford Hospital and Clinics, which is the adult hospital, and both of these hospitals do both inpatient and outpatient care. They moved from IDX to Epic. They're about probably 3 years behind the pediatric hospital in terms of their implementation. One of the advantages of both of these implementations was that we were able to take advantage of a process that had kind of gathered up and cleaned up to some extent legacy clinical data. So in our clinical data warehouse, we have data that goes back to 1995 at Stanford University Medical Center. And so early on in this project, I decided that I had to have a single sentence, and I'm told that this is grammatically correct, that if you just wanted to take away one slide, this is basically my answer to the question, what is STRIDE? And it's STRIDE was intended, is indeed a secure, HIPAA-compliant, integrated repository of clinical and research information in the form of structured biomedical data, electronic documents, and imaging data that's linked by a common database model using national, international data representation standards. And it's designed specifically to support Stanford University Medical Center's clinical and translational research mission. So in a mouthful, that's fundamentally what STRIDE is and our motivation in doing this project. So to give you an overview, there are four components to STRIDE at Stanford. The first, and you can think of these as essentially a service that we provide. In addition to this being an informatics research and development project, it's also an effort to deliver services to the research community. And the first service is to provide efficient access to Stanford University Medical Center clinical information for research purposes. And we're going to focus on this in some detail during the talk, so I won't dwell on that. The second goal for the project was to, on the same platform as the clinical data warehouse, using the same technology, the same set of standards, was to develop a service that offered secure research data management to researchers. I'll mention this a little bit in the talk. It won't be the main focus. And this is an area where we've had some success. We have also designed into the system the ability to do enterprise-level biospecimen management. And I'll have a slide or two on that. And this is really addressing an issue most academic medical centers face, which is a multitude of biospecimen banks scattered across the enterprise, and great difficulty for researchers to discover exactly what biospecimens are available at the institution. We have, we think, a solution for that particular problem. And then the fourth component is a very important component, which is the interface between all of these ideas and technologies and services and the community that we want to serve. And we've done this by offering a free informatics consultation service where any faculty, staff, or student at Stanford University as a whole, our CTSA is a Stanford University CTSA. It's not a Stanford Medical School or Stanford University Medical Center CTSA. So we offer this, as I said, to the entire Stanford community. They can, using a web-based request, they can make an appointment, and they can come and they can meet with informatics experts. We provide a variety of different kinds of consultations, sometimes mixed around how to do research data management, how to get access to clinical data for research purposes, assistance with privacy and security issues, and also just generally putting together an IRB protocol for something that has an informatics component to it. So we've been doing this for a while before the CTSA existed. I arrived at Stanford in 2001 from the University of Pittsburgh. I report directly to the dean of the medical school, Philip Pizzo, who spent decades at the NIH Clinical Center. And Phil really gets it. He's a strong proponent of translational research. And when he came to Stanford, one of the activities that he started was developing a new strategic plan for the medical center, this was titled Translating Discoveries. It was released in January 2002, and in part, my recruitment was related to his realization that informatics was going to be a really important player in solving the problem of how you improve the overall efficiency of translational research. And we spent the first year or so of this project doing what you're supposed to do in a research project, which is looking at the literature, trying to understand what had been written to date, and in particular trying to get a sense of what the research community needed in order to be more effective at clinical and translational research. Around that time, there was an influential report from the National Academy of Sciences that was published in JAMA. It was about barriers to effective translational research. And in there were a couple of barriers that were identified that seemed to me to be specifically addressable using informatics. And so we started to think about, with obviously limited resources, what we might be able to do to tackle those barriers. And the major barrier was really the question of how researchers can have more direct access to clinical data, both for hypothesis generation, for exploratory research, and then for actual research projects. And in 2004, having conceived the name STRIDE for this nascent project, the first thing we did was to submit a research protocol to the Stanford IRB. I'll come back to that later on. And this is how we have positioned our project at Stanford. Our entire data repository project is actually a protocol that's approved by the IRB and is renewed on a yearly basis. Then in 2004, the Stanford Center for Clinical Informatics that I direct was created to engage in applied informatics research development and service delivery focused on meeting the medical center's clinical and research missions. In 2004, after a couple of years of negotiation, we partnered with our two hospitals to jointly launch the STRIDE project. There was a legal agreement that was created and signed by the partners, and it specifically stated that the purpose of the agreement was to make available all patient information maintained in an electronic form, either currently or in the future, for inclusion in STRIDE. And I'm going to come back to this later on to talk a little bit about the model that we've used to gain access to clinical information while still protecting the privacy and security of the data. So we partner and continue to partner very effectively with both hospitals. And they look to us as their enterprise-level partner for meeting the needs of researchers. And I think this is an interesting model because certainly the other institutions I've been at Harvard and at Pitt, at least the times I was there, this is often a problem that researchers are depending upon the people who operate clinical systems to meet their informatics needs and their data needs vis-a-vis research. And they're very different things. And, of course, in a clinical environment, the folks involved in clinical IT are increasingly overstretched just to operate the clinical systems effectively. They tend not to be folks who they understand clinical care well, but they don't understand clinical research. So our model at Stanford was to say, look, the research mission is based in the medical school component of the medical center. We think we understand or have a good handle on how research operates and how it should operate. Give us this responsibility. We'll take it over lock, stock, and barrel. Give us the clinical data that you gather as part of patient care, and we will take responsibility in partnership with you for delivering that information in a compliant way back to our researchers. And that model has worked very, very well for us. And, I put this up to give a sense, and I was telling Jim about this earlier, that specifically around the clinical data warehouse component of this kind of work, this is a multi-year and probably a multi-decade type activity. This is not a research activity that you can do in 1 or 2 years. And I think we've learned that in industry. Data warehouses in industry have been around for decades, and the people who understand those will tell you that it takes a minimum of 5 years to get to the point where you're really able to deliver anything useful at the enterprise level. And so I put the rest of these dates up really to kind of give you a sense that it's now April 2009, and the inception of this project was sometime in 2003, so we're about 6 years out. And I'd say that it's just really in the last 12 months that we've started to deliver services that our community begins to value and can see the benefit of. And obviously, in the long run, having the clinical and translational research community sort of partner with you and see the advantage of what you're offering is the critical thing that you need to happen. This is the notion of if you build it, will they come? Well, informatics is scattered with projects over the last couple of decades where it was built and they did not come. So it is very, very important that they come, and it has to be through a carrot, not a stick. I think that one of the issues that we face is not dissimilar from the way clinical systems were maybe 20 years ago, where people were just beginning to get a sense that it probably made more sense to develop clinical systems at the enterprise level, to have them be standards-based. I well remember being in institutions where each little department, gastroenterology, would have their own little clinical system. There was no data interchange. That would be, in most cases today, something that would not be acceptable. We're kind of back there as far as clinical and translational research information systems. Most institutions either don't have any or every researcher has their own. And we're now embarking on, I think, a long path to have these systems be accepted as enterprise-level solutions, and we need to understand what the carrot will be for the researchers in order for that to be successful. In 2008, we Stanford University received its CTSA grant, and this was good because I think one of the great things about the CTSA program is that it sort of provides what I would consider a kind of institutional or an enterprise-level framework for doing this kind of work. It almost gives it a level of credibility that it didn't have before. And we now have at Stanford, as all the CTSA programs have, we have a CTSA informatics program, and we're engaged with the research community, and we're beginning to understand their needs, and we're beginning to deliver services. So I think that was very important for us, and we're looking forward to working with the CTSA on this. And, of course, I think the other great thing about the CTSA is that it's provided a national community at the informatics level, and I know in many other domains where we're now interacting in a very useful and meaningful way with all, 38 institutions. And this is great because most of what I'm going to say today and most of what we face is exactly the same set of problems that people at other institutions have to face, and at least some of the things that we've done may be useful, and there's nothing as depressing as seeing the wheel being invented over and over and over again. So let me go on to the next slide. If you want to get more information about what we're doing, this is our website, stride.stanford.edu, and we have, as I say, more detailed information about the project at the site. So this is a very simplistic slide that tries to give you an overview of how we think about Stride at the 50,000-foot level. And the little box at the bottom is really critical. This is the foundation. We could not have built Stride without prior investment, and this is obviously not an issue at the NIH, but it could be an issue at other academic medical centers. In general, as I said earlier, the research mission at most academic medical centers is either a secondary mission for the clinical enterprise or not really on their radar at all. And it tends to be something that's identified more with the academic environment, maybe the medical school that's part of that academic health center. And it's until fairly recently, most medical schools didn't really invest a lot of money in information technology. And in order to do this, and in large part it's around two issues, protecting the data and also developing an enterprise system that has close to 24/7 availability, you've got to invest in core information technology infrastructure. You've got to have a good network. You've got to have security infrastructure. You've got to have the ability to sort of create a software engineering team if you're developing your own system that's well integrated with the IT organization. And so I had the advantage of yet another hat that I wear. I'm the CIO for the medical school. And so the Center for Clinical Informatics, which is where Stride was developed, is an integral part of a much larger organization. The folks who operate our network and our data center and the people who handle our data security all report to me, and so it gave me the advantage to sort of have the maximum amount of control over these things. But I wanted to emphasize that it's really very important, and when we were negotiating with our hospitals, the whole issue of how well we could protect the data was the single most important issue that we had to persuade them about. And so I want to make that point. And essentially the model with Stride, as you'll see, it's a large database into which we migrate clinical data from our two electronic health records. We also operate it as a platform upon which research data management applications can exist. So there's research data that goes into Stride also. And then at the next level up, we provide these four utilities, so to speak, a clinical data warehouse, a virtual biospecimen bank, a whole series of clinical research registries, each one being specifically designed for a research group that needed that kind of a solution. And interestingly, we've also, in the course of doing this, because we're merging all the demographic data from both clinical systems, we have what is the only SUMC-wide master person index. So each of the hospitals has a master person index for their electronic health record that's specific to their patient population. But this is, I would also, an integrated data repository and therefore an integrated master person index is particularly useful if you want to, for example, study a disease that begins in childhood. And there are many diseases like that, diabetes, cystic fibrosis. And so we have the ability inside our clinical data warehouse to seamlessly go across the life time of patients with specific diseases like that. And the master person index, an integrated master person index, is an important component of how you do that. This is a kind of architecture stack for the techies that are out there. I use that just as a kind of a memory aid. So Stride is built on the Oracle currently 11G database platform. Our data model is based on the HL7 version 3 RIM. We've taken some components of the RIM, and we decided this very early on. One of the things that we wanted to do at Stride was to make it as standards-based as possible. And, of course, you know, when you start thinking about data models, particularly for a data warehouse, one of the problems is you don't really know what the thing is going to look like when you're finished. And I mentioned earlier that this is potentially a decades-long project. I was talking to Jim about the MARS system at the University of Pittsburgh, which is a data warehouse that's used for both patient care and research, which has been in operation since the mid to late 80s, and it's still going strong and still being built. And so we decided we needed a standards-based data model. We use the HL7 version 3 RIM. And then, like many people doing this kind of work, we're using an EAV model, entity attributes value model, for the way we actually represent the data inside the database. We have a semantic layer in the system, leveraging on standards. The standards that we're using most frequently in the system right now are ICD-9, CPT, SNOMED, and Oryx Norm. We use the UMLS pretty extensively as a resource. So, for example, we have some mappings between these different terminologies. There's a master person index, as I mentioned, in the system, which crosses the pediatric and adult patient communities. And then we have the three service areas, so to speak, clinical data warehouse, the biospecimen repository, and research databases. And then from then on, it's a fairly typical kind of architecture as an application server and so on, up through a very complex and effective access and security layer, which allows us to do very fine-grained access right down to the level of specific individuals. It also, the system has full HIPAA-compliant auditing capabilities. And then we have a series of applications that we build on top of that. Another view of STRIDE is to sort of look at the things that we offer. This might be more of a user's view. And you can see that we have, for example, in our clinical data warehouse, a set of services. We have our consultation service. We have the things that are related to our virtual biospecimen bank. We have a whole slew of research data management applications that we're operating. And you'll see we have REDCap now, the Vanderbilt system. We're part of the REDCap. Is a very nice research data management system, which we think will probably be better than STRIDE for small research databases. And we're part of the REDCap consortium, and we're in the process of implementing REDCap. And we're specifically interested in looking at how we may be able to create some interoperability between REDCap and STRIDE itself. I'll just mention that at this point, I think one of the things that we've discovered in the last 5 years or so is that our fairly complex and expensive to build research data management applications that sit on the STRIDE platform are probably too expensive and too sort of much of overkill for many of the research data management needs that people come to us with. They come and they say, you know, I'm going to be doing a research project for a year. I'm going to have maybe 200 or 300 patients. I just have, you know, maybe 20 different data elements. And we think that REDCap is going to be a much better way to provide that kind of service to the community, probably for free, than for us to, you know, have engineers build applications specifically to handle that kind of research data management need. So let me talk a little bit about STRIDE and compliance, for want of a better word. So when we thought about doing this, one of our principal concerns and foci was to ensure that we did this in a way that maximizes the protection of the security and privacy of the data. We realized that we were asking our hospitals to give us a copy of all the clinical data that they had available to them back to 1995 and then moving forward into the future. Obviously, from their perspective, this presents, to some extent, a replication of all of the security and privacy concerns they would have just around their own clinical systems. And so it was very evident to us in thinking about how we were going to get from where we were to where we are now that we would have to come up with a model for doing this that would be would work, first of all, for the research community and would also persuade our partners in the hospitals that we could protect this data, that they were not creating a risk situation for themselves or their patients. So the first thing we said was, well, you know, really, the way we're going to do this is we are going to populate our clinical data warehouse. And it's really just a case of moving the data from the clinical systems into this into STRIDE, but we're not going to, and that system will be as secure as the clinical systems are. But we're not going to take responsibility for releasing that data to researchers. We're basically going to rely on the IRB at Stanford to manage that component, to manage data release. So we said we'll make STRIDE an IRB research protocol, and we'll go and get permission from the IRB to create this research protocol, and it'll be renewed every year. And the IRB granted waivers of informed consent and of HIPAA authorization to the project, which essentially said that we could move the data, if you like, from all the clinical systems into STRIDE so that it was integrated in one place. But obviously, you know, it would be impossible for us to go back to all of the patients and ask for their permission to do that. But we weren't in doing this bypassing the patient's right to grant consent or authorization, because we were not going to release any of the data without IRB approval. And so the notion was that we would obtain a fully identified, this is another distinction between STRIDE and some of the other systems that are out there. It's all fully identified data. Our approach is that it's relatively easy to de-identify data, but it's very hard to identify de-identified data. And we saw lots of issues that would arise with using entirely de-identified data, some of them ethical, because if you are doing research and you make some discovery based upon some patient data set, and you don't have the ability then to notify the patients that there might be a benefit, we were concerned that there would be kind of ethical issues related to that. So in essence, what happens is the data is transferred electronically from the clinical systems into STRIDE, and then if any researcher wants any of that data for research purposes, they have to go through the IRB, and if the IRB grants them the data and the conditions around the use of the data, they come to us. They go to the privacy officer, actually, who looks at that documentation, and then we get a request for that data, which we deliver back to the researcher. And, you know, this model was went through several months of both internal and external legal review and was signed off on, and we've been operating under that model since 2004. So how does this work? Well, we have our two hospitals, and again, the key point in this slide is you'll see the little green boxes. This is essentially all the places in this process where the IRB controls what goes on. In other words, they could stop this at any point, or they can decide how much of this they want to happen. So the first place where the IRB weighs in is on the process of moving data from the hospital systems into the STRIDE clinical data warehouse. That's something, as I mentioned, is governed by an IRB protocol and is reviewed on a yearly basis and has been reviewed. And then we have three services that I'm going to talk a little bit about that sit on top of the clinical data warehouse: cohort discovery, patient cohort discovery, what we call chart review or clinical data review, and data extraction service. And the data extraction, you can obviously do anonymous cohort discovery, and you'll see some screenshots of an application that we've developed to do that without exposing any PHI. So there's no IRB approval required for that. HIPAA actually allows you to do chart review prior to getting IRB approval or getting patient consent or authorization, as long as you don't use the data for anything, you don't take it away. And so we have a chart review application that we've built in, and access to that is controlled by the privacy officer. And then the data extraction piece, this is where you would actually get data out of STRIDE. At that point, you have to get IRB approval for that data. We also can move clinical data from the clinical data warehouse into STRIDE research databases. And again, the IRB needs to approve that because that's just another research use of clinical data. I should make the point that, which may not be obvious to the non-technical folks here, this is all inside a single database, so there's tremendous efficiency. We're not doing this on separate systems. It's all in the same architecture, and so it's relatively easy for us to move data if there's IRB approval from the clinical data warehouse into STRIDE databases. And then, as I mentioned, creating these databases, we have basically two kinds of applications that we can provide researchers, research data management applications, and then applications that are built on our biospecimen data management platform. And again, they both require IRB approval. So you can see that this is a highly regulated process, and one where we feel that we're being very compliant with all of the rules and regulations, and to date, thankfully, we haven't had any issues with this, and it seems to work very well. And obviously, you know, you could do data extraction from the clinical data warehouse and manually put it into a database that we create, and IRB has to approve that also. So how does data get out, and what data can get out? So here's a kind of schematic presentation of that. So you have STRIDE, and inside you've got the master person index, and we have hospital data and research data that's used to populate the master person index. So this is all done through HL7 feeds, and so now you've got this integrated master person index. You've got automated data feeds from both our hospitals, and what's not on this slide is, and I'll mention this briefly later, is that we are now putting in place ETL feeds from systems, specifically from the two electronic health record systems into STRIDE, because most electronic health records do not have outgoing HL7 feeds. And so we've also got manual entry of clinical data, the more traditional kind of research database model that goes in there. All of this gets integrated into Stride. And then how does it get out? So you can look at data that's completely de-identified using the cohort search tool that I'm going to describe in a couple of minutes. That does not require IRB approval because there's no PHI that's exposed. You can also look at fully identified data as part of, quote, preparatory to research activities. Talk about that in a minute also. And then finally, if you see a data set that looks like it would be useful for your research project, you go to the IRB and you apply to get that data, and if they approve it, we will give you the data. So in fact, there are no holes in this system. The only way you can get data out of any of the systems that are part of Stride is by going specifically to the IRB. And this works very nicely because our consultation service, we're encouraging people to come to us when they want data so that we can preview how they're going to apply for this. We can make sure they're only asking for the minimum necessary data. Sometimes researchers overstate the amount of data that they need. And also, we're concerned about where that data, if it's identified, is going to live after it leaves Stride. And so we want to make sure, even before they go to the IRB, that this is all nice and tight. So that we look on ourselves, in partnership with the hospitals, as kind of protecting the patient's rights in this model. So what I'm going to do now is talk about the three components of Stride, but largely the clinical data warehouse. And as of April 2009, you can see the counts that we have in here of data. We have data on patients going back to 1994. We've got a total of 1.3 million patients in the system. Stanford University Medical Center is probably, you know, a somewhat smaller than average size medical center in terms of the number of patients that are seen. This is in comparison, for example, to what Partners would have in its research data repository is a smaller number. We have clinical encounters, and this is a sort of a data type that we've made up where we synthesize information from ADT feeds and other sources to try and capture this notion of an interaction, a clinical encounter, between a patient and the system. This turns out to be very useful data. We have inpatient and outpatient ICD-9 coded diagnoses. We have both ICD-9 and CPT coded procedures. We have, and of course, with all of these things, we have the patient, we have the date and the time, and sometimes additional information that comes to us in VH07. We have all the surgical pathology reports back to 1995. I'll just make an obvious point here. Surgical pathology reports are a remarkably valuable data source. In many diseases, and specifically in cancer, they are the gold standard for diagnosis. And so we're specifically interested in surgical pathology reports, which is we made a big effort to go right back to 95 and get all of the surgical pathology reports, both pediatric and adult, for the medical center. We have radiology reports back to 2004. Then all of the other clinical transcriptions in the system of about 4.5 million back to 2000. We have 91 million lab test results back to 2000, and we, in June of this year, will release a new version of the clinical data warehouse that has all of the pharmacy orders, I'll mention this later, back to 2006. And we have data going back further, I think an additional 2 years that we're looking at integrating into that. That's the pharmacy orders. So the point of this slide I'm about to show you is to just illustrate the fact that nothing in life is simple. And so, and I know this is Jim was saying, this is basically what you're doing here. So the first thing you're doing when you set up a data repository is you try to get all the feeds that the clinical systems are getting. And so we've done that, and these are all the lab tests and pathology and radiology transcriptions, a whole variety of other things, ADT feeds, all the things that are going in. Electronic health record systems, by and large, are not designed to spit anything out in HL7. And so you've got a big problem because most of the really valuable data that's in the electronic health record is actually coming via manual data entry. So, in clinical documentation and CPOE and that kind of stuff. And so we set STRIDE up, and the first phase of STRIDE was essentially to replicate all the HL7 feeds. So we're essentially now getting real-time HL7 feeds. Anything that goes into either electronic health record at Stanford, pretty much to the same second, goes into STRIDE. But all the data that's been manually entered is not available via HL7 feeds. So the question is, how are you going to get that in? And this is the phase of the project we started just in January of this year. And this is an inevitable phase that anybody faces in having to do this project. So we're basically doing this in a phased approach. The first thing we did was to essentially work with the hospitals so that we could obtain complete access to what are called the CDRs. These are the clinical data repositories. So all electronic health record systems, the big ones anyway, contain a sort of a system which is a copy of the data that's in the clinical database, usually in a different database format, because electronic health record systems are transaction-based systems that are, somewhat efficient at handling transactions about individual patients. They have a variety of tools that allow you to get information out on a specific patient or maybe a small group of patients, but they're not very good, nor are they designed to allow you to get information out on large groups of patients or to search across the entire database looking for cohorts. So we're developing what are called ETL connections, which are extract, transform, and load connections between these CDRs, these clinical data repositories, in both Cerner and in Epic, and bringing them into STRIDE in a phased fashion. And we're looking at that. This brings up a very interesting question about what data do you want to have in your data repository? I mean, if you start, we've looked now in detail at the data models for both of these systems, Cerner and Epic. And there are a vast number of data elements. And the question is, okay, maybe you'll say you want everything, but you're not going to be able to necessarily take everything at once. And so what do you want? So we're in the process right now of beginning to create a sort of a priority list. And I'll just say one of the things that's way up the top of our list are problem lists. And this is because you may think, well, gee, you have all these ICD-9 diagnoses, but ICD-9 diagnoses are not terribly accurate. And, in fact, there's been a great discussion on the ACME, the American College of Medical Informatics, mailing list in the last week or two about this. And I think it's okay to talk about this. I mean, this was an interesting phenomenon where, without the details, a patient who was getting care in an institution that was transferring data to one of the commercial personal health record systems, looked at his data and saw a whole bunch of diagnoses just didn't seem right to him. And it turned out that people dug into this, that there's a lot of inaccuracy in ICD-9 coding, because some of it is done to maximize billing, and it's not necessarily the inpatient stuff, it's not necessarily done by clinicians and so on. And so I think we have to be very careful about the saying that, for example, ICD-9 diagnoses that we get out of clinical systems are necessarily the gold standard for understanding what's really happening to the patient. Probably a better source is problem lists, and problem lists exist in most of these electronic health records. And so one of the things we're looking at early on, probably starting this summer, is moving the problem lists over out of both Cerner and Epic into the clinical data warehouse, but trying to sort of capture them in some standardized way. I want to make this point that you, when you've got the HL7 feed, that's only the beginning of the solution. And of course, it's a moving target. Implementation goes over many years. So, for example, our cancer center just recently migrated to clinical documentation in Epic, and so there's a change in where the data lives. And so this is going to continue to happen over the next number of years as both of the systems at Stanford are implemented, and we're going to have to sort of stay on top of what's happening in terms of where clinical data is being captured and understand how we can get that into the data warehouse. That I mentioned, we get data from the registries. So let me talk about some of the tools that we've developed that sit on top of STRIDE. So I was sharing with Jim over lunch, probably boring his pants off, but so I won't talk about Jim's age. But I remember well when you wanted to get a Medline search, you had to go to a librarian. And you had to sit down with somebody who was usually female, and you had to explain what your area of research and interest was, and usually the person had no idea what you were talking about, and it was left up to them to construct the Medline query, and they'd say, come back in a week or two, and we'll see what we have for you. And you'd come back, and in my experience, sometimes they did well, sometimes, you know, it was a very unsatisfactory process. And this is kind of where we are right now with access to clinical data for research purposes. You have to go through an analyst. I suspect it's a very unsatisfying process for researchers. And, you know, my personal goal over some extended period of time would be to sort of get us to the PubMed model of access to clinical data while protecting patient security and privacy. So the first thing we wanted to do was we wanted to provide a way to have researchers directly query the clinical data that we have in our clinical data warehouse. And in doing that, we also had to make sure we didn't expose any protected health information. And there are nuances to that I'll come to. So this application here, you can still hear me on the microphone, I guess, right? Okay. I'm going to move out here. I hope I'm not in anybody's way. So this is called the Anonymous Patient Cohort Discovery Tool. And in essence, this is a Java application. It runs on the Mac and PC. Anybody at Stanford can access this. Essentially, when you start up, you have over here in this left-hand column, you've got a series of kind of data elements or criteria that you can drag over. And it allows you to create fairly complex queries, we think, in a somewhat intuitive fashion. We've offered training to faculty on this, and they tell us we don't need it. We just figured out how to make it work the first time we used it. So we think that probably means it was engineered reasonably well. And so you can see here, this is the query. This is an example. You can drag over age, and then you have a variety of operators that you can apply. There's an encounter date. This is a way of saying that you don't want to look at any data in the clinical data repository, for example, before a specific date. You can query by ICD-9 diagnoses. You have the ability to OR criteria. You can AND them also by putting in multiple examples. You can query by lab test results. You can either put specific values in, or you can say as high, as low, and so on. And you get the general idea. And you can even say, I'm only interested in seeing having patients included if they have a pathology report. And this works in real time. This query probably took about maybe 45 seconds. And what it does is it comes back to you and it says, you know, I think there are about 400 patients in the data repository that may meet your criteria. Now, I'm being tentative here because you'll see in a second we have another tool to help you sort of really answer the question. And people love this. And essentially, it allows people, I believe that there are a lot of small but important research projects that never get beyond the shower in the morning phase. This is what we call it. You're in the shower and you think, you know, I wonder do we have any patients like this that we could look at. But, you know, in many institutions, it is going to the librarian, and, you know, people just don't have the time for that. This allows you 24/7 to log into this system and to ask questions. And really, all it does is it gives you a number. And it gives you a little bit of demographic information. You can't use this system to triangulate down to an individual or a small group of individuals. It uses some very clever statistical techniques to essentially prevent you doing that. So it's a very secure system. And it's considered to be very valuable by our researchers at Stanford because it gives them direct access to the clinical data and lets them answer this seemingly trivial question, are there any patients who have these particular characteristics? So what do you do then? So, don't know where I got that. Well, this gives you a ballpark figure. So this says there may be 400 patients. And clearly what you need to do next is you need to look at the data. And this is something that we have discovered to be absolutely true. Only the researchers know what they need from the data. There's no way that an analyst can do this. And so people said, you know, this is great, but this next phase that you make me go through where you know, the analyst extracts the data. I have to go through the whole IRB thing, and then I get the data on a disk, and I look at it, and half of it is no good. That's not good. That's not going to fly. So we said, well, we're going to need to build a tool for cohort review. So this is essentially when you launch that tool. Now, to get into this tool, because it's partially identified data, we're de-identifying a lot of data on the fly, but, you know, de-identification is like pregnancy. You either are or you aren't. And so we don't feel that at this point, given the kind of data we have, we can guarantee 100% the data is de-identified. So you still have to go through a bureaucratic process to get access to this data. But what this does, so this is the same cohort I just showed you. These are pediatric patients with inflammatory bowel disease. And you can see when you go in, it gives you a report. And you can come back to this multiple times, and it keeps kind of a record of what you've done and what the status of the cohort is. And so what it's doing is it's saying, okay, you know, here are the list of patients, and you'll see in a second you can go into each of these charts and you can look at the data and you can decide whether you want to include the patient, exclude the patient from the cohort, or you haven't decided yet. And as you do, these statistics over here are updated in real time because people need to know, sometimes at least, that they have a particular demographic distribution of the data. And we found that sometimes the data is there, but it's there and it's skewed in such a way. It's all the males, for example, for some reason that have the right data. So the research project is not going to work because it has to be a balance of male and females. Or it has to be a balance, for example, of particular ethnic groups. So this is a way, it's kind of a dashboard that allows you for, and you can have, basically each user can have as many of these cohorts in the system. They go in, they get a directory of all their cohorts, they can open one up and they're in their work environment, and basically it allows them to get the overview. And you can see that here's the status for the patients that are this person has only gotten down to number 23 in the list. And you can leave notes that say, you know, for example, why you included or didn't include a patient. And then you have this. So the other thing we found was we were sending people to look at the clinical systems, completely the wrong model because those systems are not well designed. People sometimes want to go right into the data and they want to ask a very specific set of questions that are going to help them determine whether the data is appropriate for their research project or not. So this is our patient cohort data review tool. This is the second tab up here. This cohort patient list was the screenshot I showed you just a moment ago, which is the dashboard view of all the patients. This is an individual patient. You can see over here what you have is a list of data elements. And if you want to filter out certain kinds of data, let's say you're only interested in looking at the pathology reports, what you do is you can just turn off all of these except for pathology reports, and all the other extraneous data disappears. And people love this. So this is a way for you to apply filters very quickly onto the data. It also shows you some summary information over here. For example, it shows you the ICD-9 diagnosis this patient has, the number of times that the person had the diagnosis, the procedures they had, and so on. And then you have the data elements over here. You can sort by various criteria. At this, we're looking at a lab test result. You can see the lab test result. Data is here. We flag things as being abnormally high, abnormally low. And then if you, we have a search feature, and this is the thing that really makes this very powerful. So if you want to just search for a phrase like colitis, you can, in this slide, what's happened is the person who's using it has turned off all of these data elements, and they've left on only pharmacy, transcriptions, radiology, pathology, and labs. And when they do their search, it's only going to search the things that are active. And what it's done is it's found everywhere in the patient's chart, research chart, where this phrase occurs. And then you can just click on it. I've blacked out some PHI here. And you can see that they're highlighted. And so this makes it, to date anyway, a very, very, very efficient way to rapidly get into a chart and see whether, from your perspective as the researcher, this data is going to be useful or not. And because you've no idea what criteria an investigator is going to use, you have to make it as maximally flexible as possible. And the whole idea here is to make a decision about this patient and then to go down and click one of the boxes at the bottom here. So you say, include this patient in my cohort, exclude them, or I haven't decided yet. And when you're done this process, either because you've got a critical mass of number of patients for your project or you review the entire data set, that gets stored away inside Stride. And when you then come back with your IRB protocol, we will only extract the data on the patients that you've decided you want to be in this particular protocol. So it's essentially a process for including and excluding patients. And it so far seems to work pretty well. And this is obviously extensible. As we add new data elements, we have the ability to put those data elements into this system. I mentioned very briefly drug representation. This is work that we're just wrapping up, and we've submitted a paper to Amy on this, so I'll just give you some highlights. So drug data is very important from a research perspective. We wanted to do this in a way that was standards-based. We developed a mechanism. We're getting drug data from two separate electronic health records, Cerner and Epic. They're using two different drug information systems. And so we had to come up with an algorithmic mechanism to extract ingredients from the HL7 messages and map them automatically to OrexNorm. That's worked very well for us, a success rate of around almost 95%. We map directly into the OrexNorm ingredient queries, and then through that we're able to map out to SNOMED, to the pharmacologic classes, to the substance tree. And so when this goes live in June, we hope we'll have the ability to search for patient cohorts using ingredients and pharmacologic class. So you can go in and you can create a cohort search, and you can add in those two additional criteria. And you'll be able to obviously view that data in the chart review tool and then extract the data out for research purposes. Very quickly on the research data management side of things, we've developed a whole slew of these. This is one, just to give you an example. That's a multimedia research data management tool that's used by the entire Department of Dermatology at Stanford. Basically, they have their own separate IRB protocol that allows them to register all their patients into this. They capture a lot of very detailed clinical and research information and clinical photography. This is built right into Stride. No one else can get access to this information, just the people who are approved by the IRB protocol, but it's built right into Stride and could be used for other purposes. And, for example, we can link data in this with IRB approval out to the biospecimen repository so that when they do skin biopsies, there's an automatic link between the biopsy data and the data, the clinical data that's in here. The virtual biospecimen bank, so fundamentally this is an attempt to allow our researchers to ask the question, does Stanford have tissue with these characteristics? It's a very hard thing to do in many institutions because tissue is considered a highly valuable resource. Most research groups have their own tissue banks. Sometimes they're not that interested in sharing information about their tissue. And so what we did was, we said, look, we're going to develop an application that's very sophisticated that allows you to adopt a standards-based approach to registration, distribution, tracking, searching, and reporting of tissues, and we'll give it to you for free. And in return, what you'll agree to do is to have your tissue appear in the Stride biospecimen locator, which is and we have about 43,000 biospecimens in the system right now. These are two screenshots of the application that we give to people. It's a very sophisticated application. But more importantly, from our research community perspective, you get to use this application. So this allows you to go in. It's completely de-identified information, and it allows you to create a sort of like a cohort query for tissue. And you can see here that the researcher has said, well, I'm interested in tissue from these three anatomic sites. The diagnosis was cancer. The histopathologic diagnosis was adenocarcinoma. It was a primary tumor in men between 35 and 70. It's obtained at surgery, not autopsy. And there's a universal consent type search. And in about 10 seconds, it comes back and it says, I've searched through all the tissues. And there's 30 samples from 20 patients. And here's where it is. And if you click on that, what you do is you get an automated request form that comes up. And that automatically sends the request to the right person. And from then on, it's sociology. It's between you and your maker, so to speak. So we're kind of brokers. You know, we think of this as, we call this the matchmaking application. The idea basically is you define the criteria and then we're going to get out of the way and hope that it all works. And this is working very well. So finally, I want to wrap up by talking about what I think is a very important and difficult to solve problem, and that is the whole issue of integrating document-based data. So, large amounts of clinical data in the patient record is trapped in narrative text documents. Now, historically, a lot of that data is dictated. Some institutions continue to dictate. There's a current trend towards getting clinicians to click boxes and type into clinical documentation. But fundamentally, in many cases, the text you type in is still narrative-free text. And I think if you look at the limitations of some of the coded data that we have in the systems, you realize that this is very valuable data and we need to figure out how we're going to extract and standardize it. And, there are many different kinds of these documents that exist. And we have a project that's been going on as part of STRIDE for a couple of years now called Chart Index, and it's basically a natural language processing project that can automatically do some of this. In our in the clinical data warehouse right now, we have about 7.5 million full-text clinical documents. All of them are currently indexed using Oracle Text, which is a full-text indexing module as part of the Oracle suite. You can search across all the documents for words or phrases in the clinical documents as part of the cohort tool. But it has a lot of limitations, and it doesn't support your ability to search inside a section, saying, "I'm looking for this phrase, for example, in the findings section of a radiology document." And maybe most importantly, it doesn't handle negation detection. So you go in and you put in pneumonia, and it'll come back and say, "Hey, I've got a gazillion radiology reports with pneumonia, but I can guarantee if you start looking at those, the majority of them are going to say no evidence of pneumonia." So that's not going to be helpful. So Chart Index, and we've written a number of papers on this. My colleague Yang Huang, who was my PhD student, this was his PhD thesis in informatics. Yang is now at Kaiser. And we developed a system that basically can take a variety of clinical documents, parse them into a CDA, clinical document architecture compliant XML format, and then we use a statistical natural language parser that's augmented with specialist lexicon from the UMLS to extract out standardized terms for all the noun phrases. And we've been doing, we've evaluated this with radiology reports, and we've just completed a project evaluating it against surgical pathology reports, and we'll hopefully have a paper in AMI on that this year, and it works very well. And we're interested now in applying this to discharge summaries. And we think this will be a very, very interesting way to sort of automatically structure data for research purposes so that we can kind of capture the content of clinical documents in a standardized way. And it also handles negation detection very nicely. It's about 95% accurate at detecting negation. So it can actually mark up the noun phrases as being negated or not negated, which eliminates a lot of stuff. All right, two quick slides at the end. You can look at these online. There are lots and lots of informatics opportunities in this, supporting better temporal logic and cohort searching, standards-based representation of data in clinical documents, how you better integrate clinical data warehouse data into research data management solutions. One area that we're very interested in is the notion of research data alerts, and I was telling Jim about this. This is the idea that many institutions have where they want to, often in the emergency room, they want to know about patients arriving in the emergency room with a particular problem. Often those people come in, they're seen and they're gone, and the question is there a way that we can detect this in real time and notify recruiters for a clinical trial? And so we're going to build a system that basically, because we're getting all of the HL7 messages, as soon as that person hits the emergency room, that ADT record is in STRIDE. And we want to basically create a system that with IRB approval that would allow individual research groups to create their own research alerts. So they could say, if you see patients in these locations with these criteria, send a pager message to this particular pager. Not any PHI, just send them a message so they can log in and see what the story is. Data and text mining, a very important area of informatics research as you accumulate these large data sets. And then something the CTSA is focusing on, which is, you know, can we kind of multiply the effect here? Can we, if we have all these data repositories emerging, is there a way that we can federate searches so that you can search across multiple repositories and ask questions of much larger sets of data? Maybe you want to use that for recruiting into multi-center clinical trials. And then finally, the last slide is the challenges. There are lots of challenges on this. I mentioned earlier one of the big questions is, you know, exactly what you put into the research clinical data warehouse versus what you just leave in the electronic health record. There's the whole question of how we're going to represent data trapped in clinical documents. There's a real issue of sustainability. You know, when you're developing an enterprise system, and really it's a system that takes 5 years before it's got anything important to offer, and you're thinking like Mars, it's going to be around for 20 or 25 years, you have to think very hard about how you're going to make this sustainable beyond the initial excitement or the initial grant funding that gets this off the ground. I mean, this is the same issue as an electronic health record systems have. You've got to be thinking about how you're going to operate and maintain this system for maybe decades. And then finally, and you know, the thing that we've certainly learned in informatics is that this is all fundamentally a question of culture and workflow. It's not about technology. Most successful researchers are entrepreneurs. Most institutions say to their researchers, you can get funding for this work, we'll get out of the way as long as you're being compliant, let you get on with your work. And so researchers for decades now have kind of adopted the model that they have to do it themselves. And we need to turn that around. We need to sort of say to people, you know, we have these tools that can make you more efficient and more effective, and you shouldn't be wasting your time doing things that informatics expertise can do for you much better at the enterprise level, perhaps cheaper. And that is going to be a very, very hard thing to do. And even so, this is the if you build it, will they come phenomenon. And I just want to acknowledge we have a great team of people working at Stanford on this project. I'm just kind of the architect and spokesperson, but all of these folks do the work on a daily basis. And that's it. So I'm a little bit over. I apologize, but it's a lot of material. Thank you.
Thank you, Henry. Maybe we could take one or two questions real quick.
Sure.
Before Henry has to leave.
Thank you for your presentation. It looks to me like Stride is ideally suited for data mining and retrospective analyses of data sets and patients that came in for standard of care, so forth. Be interested to hear a little bit more about prospective data management. So is this suited for people who come in and are entered into a research protocol? And the protocol will require randomization, and they'll be testing at various landmarks prospectively. Is this really suited for that kind of prospective data management or not?
Yeah, it is, actually.
So that in real time someone can look at their data as they're being accrued and so forth.
Well, I mentioned earlier I de-emphasized that component because I wanted to focus on the clinical data warehouse piece of this and access to clinical data. So we have developed a whole variety of very complex data registries for prospective studies in Stride. You know, the model is that we want to, first of all, provide standards-based prospective research data management. And we want to have the research projects that are using those kinds of applications on Stride be able to take advantage of all the other things we can do. So, for example, we have a very nice joint replacement registry that we've built for the orthopedics department, and we're integrating PACS data into that, for example, prospectively. So when patients have their imaging studies pre- and post-surgery, that data automatically appears. We're going to be adding in the ability to sort of add in lab test results without having to manually enter them and so on. And that's a very important part of what we do. I just didn't emphasize. Now, I mentioned earlier that for small projects, we think this is too expensive and too complicated, frankly. And that's why we're in the process right now of implementing REDCap, which we think can probably meet the needs of smaller research projects for a much smaller amount of time and effort. Any other questions?
You mentioned de-identification several times.
Yeah. I'm
just curious, is there any wisdom you could impart on people investigating de-identification, given that you have experience with it?
I'm not sure I've got any specific wisdom, except that I think it's a really hard problem. I mean, I think, you know, there are... I don't think that there is either commercially or available a generalizable solution to this. I think that there's literature on this in informatics, and people have done it very well for certain subsets of the data. We worry about the fact that if you stamp something as being identified, the IRB applies a different set of rules and regulations to that data. I mean, if somebody goes to the IRB, they can say, I'm only asking for de-identified data. They can get an expedited review, and in fact, the data can be released. And once it's released, you know, theoretically, though, it doesn't happen like this. That data can be used for anything. It could be put on the internet. And I certainly have looked at enough of this data to be worried about the nuances. And I'll give you one example, maybe it's for my last comment. So I'm in the middle of Silicon Valley, and I was looking for quality assurance purposes at some of the data, and I was looking at a clinic note, and it was beautifully de-identified, except for the fact that it had a sentence in there, and it said, you know, this patient is the CEO of a startup in Silicon Valley, and it had the URL. I mean, only at Stanford, right? And when if you clicked on that URL, you would get to their website and you'd see who the CEO was. I don't know how a de-identification algorithm is going to pick up that. I mean, there's all kinds of ways, you know, that you can identify somebody. You know, it's the classic example of identifying John Kennedy. Not that this happened, but one could. Latanya Sweeney, who's done a lot of this work, has shown, for example, that you can, using public records, and she did this with Governor Weld, who was the governor of Massachusetts at the time, just using public data, you can often identify people. So what we do is we unless it's structured data, like lab data and ICD codes and so on, we won't release it as de-identified. We basically say, you know, we'll do the best we can, but we can never be absolutely sure. And so that's kind of currently the approach we're taking to that. So thank you.
You've been listening to a presentation on Stanford University's STRIDE program, presented by Dr. Henry Lowe, Associate Professor of Medicine, Biomedical Informatics, and Director of the Center for Clinical Informatics and Senior Associate Dean for Information Resources and Technology at Stanford University School of Medicine. For more information about the BTRS program at the NIH Clinical Center, log on to btris.nih.gov. And for more information about the clinical research going on every day at the NIH Clinical Center, log on to clinicalcenter.nih.gov. The NIH Clinical Center Biomedical Translational Research Informatics Seminar Series podcast has been a presentation of the NIH Clinical Center Office of Communications, Patient Recruitment and Public Liaison. From America's Clinical Research Hospital in Bethesda, Maryland, I'm Bill Schmalfeld at the National Institutes of Health, an agency of the United States Department of Health and Human Services. Thank you.